This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Body of the World, a memoir, and Christine Schuler Describer, Congolese human rights activist, director of the City of Joy. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Armate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Annie Masood, Ravi Karantina, Gazdari, Me Little, Phil Martinez, Doris Danimo, Alan Mike, DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julia Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matte. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard around the web at www.kboo.fm. Up next is the KBOO Evening News, right after these messages.
Tune in, turn on, and remember 45 years of KBOO history. This Tuesday, June 25th, from 6 to 7 p.m., it's a special monthly program focusing on KBOO's history to mark our 45th anniversary year.
This month, we focus on the Pacifica radio crisis of 1999, when a grassroots effort across the country, including here at KBOO Radio, came together to save the Pacific Radio Network from an attempted corporate takeover.
That's this Tuesday, June 25th, from 6 to 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lilith's Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
the U.S. Supreme Court has overturned a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. We'll get a response from a national civil rights group.
The Oregon State Legislature votes to ban the production of canola in the Willamette Valley, mainly due to concerns about the spread of genetically modified strains.
And budget cuts in Washington have led to a reduction in the so-called striker brigades based in Fort Lewis near Olympia. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 25th, 2013. I'm Alex Ward.
And I'm Don Merrill. The Oregon House passed legislation today that will limit the production of canola in the Willamette Valley. House Bill 2427 passed the House by a 37-22 vote. The bill now heads to the Senate. For more on this legislation, here is Representative Sarah Gelsor, a sponsor of the bill.
This bill will allow the Department of Agriculture to authorize the planting of up to 500 acres of canola in the Willamette Valley Protected Area to allow the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University to conduct a peer-reviewed study on the risk of growing such crops. The bill prohibits raising canola within the Willamette Valley Protected District until 2019 unless it is part of the study. Oregon State University is directed to report study results to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly by November 1, 2017. This bill includes a general fund appropriation to Oregon State University to support 3 years of research work by the College of Agricultural Sciences. As originally introduced, House Bill 2427 would have banned all canola in the entire Willamette Valley forever. And many people argued that that was just a little bit too much, which is why this bill has been amended. The first thing that's important is that this is not a permanent ban on growing in the canola in the Willamette Valley. It is only a timeout that maintains the protected district that has been in place since 2006 until we are able to complete some more peer-reviewed scientific research on this issue. This means we are not permanently overruling a rule of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Colleagues, I think this is a smart bill that protects a key industry in our state, that gives us a brief time out to allow us to make the best possible decision based on unbiased, peer-reviewed research from Oregon State University. I look forward to a good debate here. I know this is a difficult vote for many people. This is an issue that has the interests of some farmers, and other farmers are not necessarily aligned. All good people, all good business people, I believe our job here today is to look at the interests of that $50 million industry, and I hope you will join me in supporting this compromise bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
That was House Representative Sarah Gelsor, a sponsor of legislation that will temporarily limit the production of canola in the Willamette Valley. The 30-minute debate on the bill leading up to the vote features concerns from lawmakers on both sides of the issue. Here is Representative Jim Thompson.
Canola is not being introduced into the valley. It's been here for 20 years. The last few years, it was grown under permit from the Department of Agriculture. So we're not keeping purity in the valley by keeping it out. It's already been here. But what it does do, it's another bill that costs us jobs. It costs us jobs in the farming of canola, it costs us jobs in the processing of canola, and it costs us jobs in the oil purification of canola oil. Much of it would probably end up going on the international market as food grade oil. And this is not a time I think we should be taking those risks. It also costs the state export income, and we need that income desperately right now.
That was Oregon House Representative Jim Thompson speaking against passage of House Bill 2427. Many farmers in the Willamette Valley are supporting the legislation, according to Leah Rogers, field director of Friends of Family Farmers.
We have been working very closely with farmers and advocating for canola restrictions and to keep these boundaries in place and not allow canola production because of the risks canola poses to the specialty seed industry by way of cross-contamination. Canola is a very promiscuous brassica. Same family as broccoli, kale, cabbage, kohlrabi, pak choi, to name a few. And it also incubates some pretty gnarly pests and diseases. And so with large-scale commodity production of canola, which a lot of it is GMO, then, you know, not only are your organic industries at risk, but your fresh market vegetables are susceptible to these increased pest and disease issues.
What impact will this legislation have on the fight over genetically modified crops in Oregon?
You know, this is going to be such an interesting thing to watch. The Department of Agriculture follows the lead of the federal government, and the federal government has deregulated GMO canola. And so as such, our state Department of Agriculture says, well, that's good enough for us. So they are not going to draw any distinctions between conventional canola, GMO canola, or, say, organic canola, although there is a market for some non-GMO organic canola oil. I know there's a little bit of interest with some farmers to do that. But regardless, it still has the same, if it's GMO or not, it still has the same impact. So we have been down in Salem quite a bit, and we've also been helping to organize folks on the ground to weigh in on this important issue. It's no longer an idea. You know, now it's in the House of Representatives, who has passed it, and now onto the Senate. And this bill has a very good likelihood of becoming a law. And I think what we've seen here is kind of a shakeup in some of the traditional agribusiness lobby and traditional ag groups that are, you know, typically rule the roost in Salem. And I think what we've shown here is that you can't do that without people power, without the grassroots also weighing in.
That was Leah Rogers from the group Friends of Family Farmers speaking with KABU earlier today about the passage of House Bill 2427, which temporarily limits canola production in the Willamette Valley.
GOP Chairwoman Susan Gallagher issued a press release claiming that undocumented workers in Oregon cost taxpayers $1 billion a year. The data was cited from a report from the right-wing anti-immigration organization Oregonians for Immigration Reform. Their data for Oregon was taken from a December 2012 report by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a Washington, D.C. anti-immigration organization. The Oregon Center for Public Policy did an economic analysis of this issue in January of 2012. They estimated that there are about 200,000 undocumented workers in the state who earn between $2 and $4 billion a year, which they spend on goods and services. The center also estimates that these workers pay between $200 to $300 million in taxes, including Social Security and Medicare taxes, that they will never be able to collect benefits from because they're not eligible. In addition, they pay property, state, and local taxes, and their employers pay taxes on behalf of the workers. A 2007 study from the Federal Council of Economic Advisors concluded that total income gains from immigration are over $30 billion a year to the national economy, and that reducing immigration would be a poorly targeted and inefficient way to assist low-wage Americans. According to the Center for American Progress, credible economists conclude that these workers in general are makers, not takers.
Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber said today that a deal between Oregon Republicans and Democrats could bring about a budget deal without having to include new tax cuts for the rich. Kitzhaber criticized the new tax cut proposed this week by Republican Senator Brian Boquist of Dallas and Larry George of Sherwood. He said the tax policy is usually not crafted in the manner of a week, referring to the fact that the Oregon State Legislature is scheduled to adjourn at the end of the week unless a budget deal has not been reached by that time. The Boquist-Sherwood proposal would reduce the maximum tax rate for business owners from 9.9% to 7%. That would affect Oregon business owners who pay taxes based on their personal income rather than corporate taxes. The proposed cap is $10 million on Oregon income. Governor Kitzhaber said he would only consider signing such a budget if the tax cuts included some kind of sunset and suggested that they should end after 4 years.
Tomorrow afternoon, neighbors of the Elliott community plan to launch 100 tethered red balloons to protest a planned development by the Kaiser Group. The balloons will be tethered along the sidewalks on the corner of Northeast Fremont Street, North Williams Avenue, and Northeast Ivy Street. They will visually represent the requested height of 85 feet or 8 stories of the proposed Backbridge lofts. Red Balloons for Reason say they are trying to bring awareness to the recent request by the Kaiser Group to change the comprehensive plan map designation from medium-density, multi-dwelling, to central residential. This request for a zoning change by the Kaiser Group was made on April 1st and was met by community opposition. Several people testified at a recent city council meeting opposing the change.
So I'm very close to this. This is going to completely, you know, change the way our lives are. And I just want to stand up for, like, my neighbor Lawrence, who's lived in the neighborhood for 50 years, and my neighbor Uncle Charles, who's lived in the neighborhood his whole entire life. I mean, these guys, they're not here because they're at work, but they're scared that there's going to be this huge building pressed right up against their house, and it scares me as well. My main concern is parking, and if there was, you know, parking that went down, that would be great, you know, down into the, like, if they built it in. I'm concerned about the traffic. I have a small child. I'm planning to be in the neighborhood forever, and I just want it to be safe. And it's hard to get on my driveway, and with the developments continuing, the traffic is just crazy. Sometimes I can't even get on my driveway, and sometimes, like, with all the cars parked right up against my house, I can't see. So, you know, I'm concerned about that, and I think the traffic lights would be great. But I'm also, you know, concerned about just getting our voices heard, you know, that this is our neighborhood. This isn't a new neighborhood. This has been around. And even though I'm new to the neighborhood, I feel like we need to respect the neighbors who have been there for 50, 60 years and have a voice for them. So I think that it be nice to have something there, but maybe just not give, you know, a lot of open-ended faith, you know, put some rules, put some restrictions so that we can all be happy.
I'm Christopher Knepper, and I live on 3736 Northeast Cleveland, one block east of Williams. I've lived there for 22 years. I lived there before anybody wanted to live there. I work with Legacy. I know what it's like coming off of the 405 bridge and trying to cross over to Cook. The gentleman over there said that he would never put a real tall building right next to some low houses. One block south of me, there is a 44-unit apartment complex. If you get a picture of it, there are some one- and two-story. Granted, they're older homes and everything right behind it. I don't know how the rose bushes get any sunlight. But I look out my front window now, and I see that 44 thing, and I thought, how are they ever going to get something even 6 or 8 stories tall? I know parking and noise is going to be a part of life, but not something that's almost as big as what we have downtown. And I'm begging you to kind of let my neighborhood be the way that it was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Originally, Kaiser had requested a 45-foot high building. The new proposal is double that size, which would make the new building one of the tallest residential building outside the Pearl District in downtown. The Red Balloons for Reason event will be held tomorrow from 4 to 7 p.m. at Northeast Fremont and North Williams.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by Tune In, Turn On, and Remember at 6. Tonight's show takes a look at the Pacific Radio Crisis in 1999 and the role KBOO played in reporting the fight against a corporate takeover. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather forecast shows a 50% chance of rain with a high near 73.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let's go cruising again. Yes, take another wild and crazy ride with me down the twisted road of Texas Senator Ted Cruz's mind. The new darling of Tea Party Republicans got elected last year in part by stoking right-wing fear that the United Nations is planning to seize America's golf courses. Riding that momentum, Cruz is now gaining national notoriety as a senator who takes extremism to the extreme and beyond. Ted's latest trip swerves through the immigration debate. He uses the personal saga of his father to make the case that there should be no path to citizenship for the millions of undocumented immigrants living here, no matter how much they're contributing to our economy and society. Daddy Cruz, he points out again and again, followed the rules 66 years ago to leave Cuba and became an American citizen. Quote, every step of the way, the elder Cruz recently affirmed in a radio interview, I have been here legally. Well, not every step. Rafael Cruz admits that he only got here by bribing a Cuban official. Technically speaking, that's illegal. Still, father and son both tear up in telling how Rafael got a job, eventually going on to start a small business and to work towards the American dream. Unmentioned in this soaring Horatio Alger tale is that Rafael did all of that American dream stuff in Canada, where he became a citizen and where Ted was born. In fact, Rafael did not become an American citizen until 2005, nearly half a century after leaving Cuba. What took him so long? I don't know, the father now says, adding ruefully, I guess laziness. This is Jim Hightower saying, really? How does that rationalize slamming America's door in the face of other hardworking immigrants? I guess Ted thinks they should have bribed their way to America.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court has overturned a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. Civil rights groups say the decision will open the floodgates for racial discrimination in states that have historically engaged in openly racist practices regarding elections. The political advocacy group Common Cause said that today's Supreme Court ruling must be answered with quick bipartisan action on Capitol Hill. In a recent study considering Section 4, the section of the law invalidated by the court today, Congress conducted more than 21 hearings with 90 witnesses and amassed a 15,000-page record documenting continuing discrimination against minority voters. For more, KBOO's Nicole Betancourt spoke with Stephen Spaulding of Common Cause.
What implications will this decision have?
Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act was a formula that Congress reauthorized in 2006 by overwhelming bipartisan majorities. It passed 98-0 in the Senate, to give you an indication of just how widely it was supported, which laid out certain states with a history of discrimination in enacting voting laws that would discriminate against voters of color. It requires those states, before they change their voting laws, to seek preclearance from the federal government and from federal judges to show why their changes in the voting laws would not discriminate against voters. So it's really the heart and soul of the Voting Rights Act. And basically what the court did today was say, actually, we don't, you know, it substituted its own judgment for that of Congress's and said, we don't really think discrimination exists anymore or enough to justify this coverage formula, and therefore they struck down the formula in whole. However, the silver lining is it did boot the question back over to Congress to say, if you still think states need pre-approval before changing their voting laws, particularly in states with a history of discrimination, Congress needs to basically update its formula with new evidence. That said, it was still a breathtakingly activist decision where we saw these five conservative justices essentially substitute their own judgment for that of Congress's.
What actions do you think those states will take? The states that no longer have those restrictions on them.
Well, we've already seen, unfortunately, for example, Texas. Texas today announced that they're going to move forward now with their voter ID law that will no doubt make it harder for certain populations to make their voices heard at the ballot box. So we've seen, we saw the Voting Rights Act stop a number of states, particularly those in the South, from enacting different changes to their voting laws that would have made it harder for young people to vote, for people of color to vote, for elderly Americans to vote, for disabled Americans to vote. Those states basically are able to move forward with changes in their laws. Now, on the other side of the coin, while those states no longer have to seek pre-approval, if the effect of those laws is to discriminate against voters, the Department of Justice still has ample authority in another section of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, to stop those practices from continuing. So states that are going to move forward with laws that have the effect of discriminating against voters on account of race will still need to justify their laws. They just won't seek pre-approval. That means it's going to be a much more expensive process, and it means that voters are going to be caught sort of in the crossfire in the confusion as these cases are argued in court. So it's really left these states with free rein to enact changes to their voting laws. That said, the Department of Justice can still step in after those laws are enacted. Prior to that, the DOJ had to authorize states to make these changes sort of before they were actually enacted.
What actions do you think Congress will take on the issue?
Certainly there are some members of the Congress that are going to cite the gridlock as an excuse for not reengaging and protecting voters, but they did it just in 2006. Congress was able to come together on a bipartisan basis and reauthorize the coverage formula. It was signed into law by President George W. Bush. There's no reason that Congress can't do this again. It's done it before. We have even more of a record, particularly as we saw in the 2012 elections of states that are rolling back early voting, cutting early voting sites, enacting these overbroad and discriminatory government-issued voter identification card schemes. And there's plenty of evidence that Congress can use to actually expand the states that would be required to come under the preclearance provision. That said, Congress needs to hear from folks across the country and their constituents that this matters. But this is really a sad day for democracy, given that this is, you know, one of, if not the most successful pieces of civil rights legislation in our history. It was just about to turn 50 years old. It's done an enormous amount of good, and here it is on the cusp of being relegated to the dustbin of history if Congress doesn't step in and reauthorize a formula to determine which states should come under its jurisdiction.
What action will Common Cause be taking in the meantime?
Well, Common Cause has rallied our members across the country to protect the right to vote, particularly in the last election. We had folks all across the country going to their polls, helping voters figure out what they needed to vote, where they needed to vote. We have a long history of advocating for this legislation on Capitol Hill. We will be putting our members in touch with their representatives on Capitol Hill, calling for reauthorization, and we'll be telling the stories of voters, voters who are our own members and members of allied organizations, about how the Voting Rights Act is critical to making their voices heard in their democracy.
I've been speaking with Stephen Spalding of Common Cause. This is Nicole Betancourt with KBU News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has told the U.S. government that he will not hand over NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Putin implied that Snowden is at the international airport in Moscow. The U.S. government has filed for a request for extradition, which the Russian government is refusing to carry out. But another Russian government official did not confirm the assertion that Snowden is, in fact, still at the Russian airport. Edward Snowden is a former private security analyst who had access to vast amounts of data supplied by the NSA. Snowden exposed the largest surveillance program to date, run by the National Security Agency, and monitoring the web traffic and emails of Americans.
The Army announced today that it is eliminating the 4th Stryker Brigade, one of three Stryker Brigades at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Stryker brigades were created in the mid-2000s in response to the desire by the U.S. military to have a more rapid response, like light mobile infantry, but with a stronger effect, like heavy armored infantry. I have more with this report. Senator Patty Murray of Washington said in a press release that she is disappointed that the brigade was being eliminated, but was encouraged that the military will be adding other battalions to the base. The Budget Control Act of 2011 prompted the elimination of the brigade. It's a preemptive cost-cutting move by the U.S. Army that some have said could eliminate up to $500 billion from the Pentagon's coffers over the next 10 years. The changes will eliminate 5,000 active duty members and another 4,500 civilian positions that support the brigade. But not everyone is upset with the reductions. Alex Bacon is the co-director of GI Voice, an advocacy organization for veterans, their friends, and families in Washington. He knows about the changes at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, but his first question asks, what is behind them?
It's really about what is it being done for. I think we've been at war since, shortly after 9/11, and if this is being done in order to divert more resources into being able to care for veterans and care for wounded soldiers, then it's great.
Coffee Strong used to be a coffee shop, but they have since gotten out of the barista business and recently moved to a larger facility because the need soldiers and their families have for services, they say the government hasn't been very good at providing veterans.
We just moved into a new expanded location because, the demand for our services has been so high from the military community that we needed to move somewhere where we had more room and more space to provide these services.
The actions at Joint Base Lewis-McChord aren't happening in isolation. Officials say sweeping changes would eliminate brigades at 10 Army bases in the U.S. by 2017, including those at Texas, Kentucky, Georgia, Colorado, North Carolina, New York, Kansas, and Washington. The Army will also cut thousands of other jobs across the service, including soldiers in units that support the brigades, and two brigades in Germany that have already been scheduled for elimination. Alex Bacon says GI Voice is doing the work the GIs can't do, but also that the government should be doing. And although nearly 10,000 positions will be eliminated in the Washington state cuts, he thinks the money could be better spent.
I mean, I think it's been well established in economic studies that, money put into defense spending is not the most efficient way to build our economy. That when you put money into providing essential services like healthcare and education and other social services, that you get a much bigger bang for your dollar. And so as an organization, we'd really like to see the money that's being saved by, eliminating these units and putting it into, the Veterans Administration, which is still badly understaffed and needs more resources.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Presidential Palace in the heart of Kabul. The bold action came just a week after Taliban leaders opened an office in Qatar for peace talks.
A Palestinian singer has, for the first time, won the Arab Idol Music Contest based on votes from people around the Arab world, including in Gulf states where prejudice against Palestinians remains a reality. The significance of the win by 23-year-old Mohammed Asaf has been recognized by Arab leaders, including Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. But his return to his home in Gaza last night showed that political divisions remain in place, despite the show of unity to support the young singer in the contest. Thousands of people took to the streets to welcome Mohammed home, but the right wing of the Hamas party and other Islamic parties did not openly voice support. Devout Muslims who support Hamas fundamentalists' brand of Islam oppose shows like Arab Idol as forbidden by their religion. And since winning the elections in 2006 and forming a government in Gaza, Hamas has imposed stricter religious rules, including more gender separation in public and in schools. Mohammed's signature song, Raise the Kafieh, is an ode to Palestinian national unity.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, June 25th, 2013. Israeli soldiers invade West Bank communities, search homes and kidnap civilians after clashing with local youth. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday at dawn two Palestinian children in Arram town, north of occupied East Jerusalem. Local sources have reported that dozens of soldiers invaded the town and clashed with local youth who hurled stones at them. The sources added that the army kidnapped the two children identified as Tariq Dwaik and Yazan Azziro. The army claimed that the invasion was carried out after Molotov cocktails were thrown at a military jeep parked near the entrance of the town. Soldiers then invaded the area and fired dozens of concussion grenades, gas bombs and rubber-coated metal bullets. In other news, a number of Israeli military jeeps invaded on Tuesday at dawn the central West Bank city of Salfit, broke into homes and searched them. Local sources reported that soldiers handed a number of residents military warrants, ordering them to head to a nearby military base for interrogation. The sources added that a number of Israeli security officers who accompanied the soldiers participated in the search of local homes and interrogated several residents. Soldiers also fired several concussion grenades and gas bombs in a number of neighborhoods in Salfit. In related news, several Palestinians have been treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes that took place after dozens of soldiers invaded Al-Izariya town in occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday at dawn, a number of military jeeps invaded Beit Sahur city near Bethlehem, broke into the home of Khalid Shaheen and violently searched it. No arrests were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, June 25th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the Cable Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Bill Riley and Nicole Betancourt. The producer is Rebecca Ney. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard in the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. Ready? The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Don Merrill.
And I'm Alex Ward. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Lisa Loving interviews Big Float organizer Will Levinson about two upcoming chances to jump into the Willamette River with 1,000 others. And inspirational swimmer Michelle Macy talks about reclaiming the Willamette River. At 9, we get reactions to this week's historic Supreme Court decisions. Peter Zuckerman of Oregon United for Marriage and others will be interviewed. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Daniel Chamovitz, author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, the guest is Kim Vakariu, Western Director for the Wildlands Network on restoring, protecting, and connecting our best wildlife places throughout North America. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Don.
Goodbye, Alex.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 25th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama outlines his plan for action on climate change, including broad cuts to carbon emissions, more funds for renewable energy, and continued support for natural gas and some coal production. And communities along the U.S.-Mexico border criticize a measure to spend billions of dollars on border security as the debate on immigration reform continues. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Three bombing attacks killed more than 30 people across Iraq Tuesday as the security situation in the country descends into another cycle of sectarian violence. The New York Times reports the deadliest attack killed 16 people and wounded more than 50 as Shiites protested insecurity with a highway blockade in the Saladin province. More than 40 people died in bombings across Iraq on Monday. The president of the Central African Republic has declared 3 days of national mourning in the wake of a gold mine collapse which killed at least 37 workers. The underground pit collapsed under heavy rain Sunday, with workers trapped inside. At least 10 injured miners have been rescued alive, but an unknown number remain trapped underground, meaning the death toll could increase. Demonstrators are gathering in cities across Turkey to protest the release of a police officer who shot and killed a protester in Ankara earlier this month. This comes as tensions between protesters and police continue in political unrest across the country. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
News footage from June 1st in Ankara captured a police officer firing his weapon 3 times in close quarters with unarmed demonstrators who were punching and kicking at riot police. One of those shots hit 26-year-old Edem Sereshuluk in the head. He died in a hospital 2 weeks later. On Monday, prosecutors ruled that the officer acted in self-defense and released him pending trial. That sparked outrage by family members and many who have decried police's heavy-handed tactics used on even peaceful assemblies. Now organizers are using social media to call people out into the streets this evening in a dozen major cities across Turkey to protest the court's action. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan continues to defend police tactics and has dismissed the protest over his perceived autocratic rule as illegitimate. Turkey's Interior Ministry estimates about 2.5 million people have taken part in demonstrations since May 31st. Doctors' groups say about 5,000 have been injured and at least 4 have died, including one policeman. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
In a follow-up to a story on Friday, the Republic of Georgia has delayed the scheduled destruction of an archive of audio and videotapes containing scenes of private life of several individuals, including public figures. Interior Minister Irakli Garibashvili said that media, civil society, and foreign diplomats need to know more about the files before they are destroyed. According to Garibashvili, a previous administration compiled the files through illegal surveillance. Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall are calling on NSA Director General Keith Alexander to correct what they say is a significant inaccuracy published in a recently released fact sheet on the agency's surveillance authorities under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. In their joint letter, the senators wrote the inaccuracy is, quote, significant as it portrays protections for Americans' privacy as being significantly stronger than they actually are. The two members of the Senate Intelligence Committee cited the inaccuracy itself in a classified attachment. This afternoon, the fact sheet was no longer available on the NSA website. A fight over the future of access to abortion in Texas is currently underway and down to the wire in the final day of the current session of the Texas legislature. FSRN's Teddy Wilson has more.
Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis took to the floor of the Texas Senate this afternoon to attempt a Texas-style filibuster to prevent the passage of regulations to restrict access to abortions in the state. This comes after the House passed the bill in a pre-dawn vote Monday, witnessed from the gallery by hundreds of silent protesters. Senate Bill 5 would place new strict regulations on clinics that provide abortions, requiring them to meet state ambulatory surgical center standards. If passed, the legislation would reduce the number of abortion clinics in Texas from around 40 to about 5. Additionally, the legislation would ban all abortions after 20 weeks of gestation. The 30-day special session of the legislature that was called by Governor Rick Perry ends tonight at midnight. Davis has vowed to continue speaking throughout the day and into the evening to prevent passage of the legislation. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, College Station.
And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, President Barack Obama outlined a climate action plan that aims to reduce carbon emissions from the U.S., increase investment in renewable energy sources, and improve infrastructure to help American cities respond to climate change. Speaking at Georgetown University, President Obama said he would take executive action to come up with a national standard for carbon cuts.
Today, for the sake of our children and the health and safety of all Americans, I'm directing the Environmental Protection Agency to put an end to the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from our power plants and complete new pollution standards for both new and existing power plants.
President Obama's announcement comes 5 years into his presidency, a time during which Congress has failed to pass a comprehensive plan on climate change, and the U.S. has repeatedly been criticized for playing a diminished role in international climate change negotiations. The president called on all nations to work toward a flexible and inclusive climate change agreement, but he also directed his remarks to a controversial domestic project, the Keystone XL pipeline, which is under review at the State Department.
Allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest. And our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution. The net effects of the pipeline's impact, on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward. It's relevant.
At the same time, President Obama continued his push for expanding natural gas despite concerns about the health and environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing.
We should strengthen our position as the top natural gas producer because, in the medium term at least, it not only can provide safe, cheap power, but it can also help reduce our carbon emissions.
For more on the president's climate action plan, we're joined by Rachel Cletus, senior climate economist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
In President Obama's first term, he committed to cutting U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. How does his proposal today on carbon emissions fit into that pledge?
Well, I want to start by saying that it was very encouraging, wonderful news today to hear President Obama come out and put some specifics out there on his climate plan to deliver on this pledge that he made to the world community. We know that climate change is an urgent issue. We're feeling its impacts all around the U.S. already through droughts, wildfires, sea level rise, and coastal storms. So it's great that we're finally hearing some specifics on how he's going to deliver on the emissions reduction pledges. The plan we heard today was very wide-ranging. It covered many areas of action related to emissions reductions as well as building the resilience of coastal communities. We know that there are ways that we can deliver on the pledge, and he's pointed out some important aspects of that, particularly the power plant carbon standards for new and existing power plants, which was a centerpiece of the speech today.
And talk more about that that part of this speech and the proposal of cutting emissions specifically at these power plants. As he noted, the power plants in the U.S. account for about a third of the nation's emissions.
Yes, the power plants, because of our dependence on fossil fuels like coal, lead to roughly a third of our greenhouse gas emissions, our global warming emissions here in the United States. And it's really critical as we address climate change to take on these emissions and find ways to reduce them. And the good news is there are a lot of ways we can do this, switching to cleaner forms of electricity generation like natural gas, renewable energy, energy efficiency. And this last year, roughly half of the new generation capacity installed was coming through renewables deployment like wind and solar.